Welcome to Design Your Life, the podcast where we explore the central role design plays in our everyday lives, and how, if harnessed correctly, has the power to positively transform the way that we live, design better businesses, and sustainable solutions for the planet. We speak to creative entrepreneurs around the world about how they inspire their ideas to life, and how they make it all work, and the role design plays in their lives. I'm your host, founder of Frost Collective, and author of Design Your Life, Vince Frost. Welcome to today's episode of Design Your Life. Today I catch up with Aidan Anderson, the founder of the incredible design publishing house, The Local Project. Tune in as we chat about his incredible journey starting and growing The Local Project and the four pivotal anchors that his life is centered on and what is next for the world of design publishing. Hey, Aidan, welcome to Design Your Life. How are you doing?
Good, Vince. Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's really cool to have you here. It's been a while in the making.
That's right. A long time coming.
And it's so cool because you're just around the corner from our studio too, and at your office and studio there.
That's right. Good little crowd here in Alexandria. So yeah. It's just a quick walk away.
Yeah. So it's been really cool because it's your brand, The Local Project, which has been going for a few years now, has really gained some amazing traction and got high visibility and really incredible work. And we'll talk about that, how it came about, which is really, really cool. But it's just now that we're kind of beginning to see the man behind the brand. And I'm really honored and pleased that you agreed to be on the podcast.
No, of course. Again, thanks for having me.
That's cool. You're the founder of, and director of The Local Project, as I mentioned. So it's an incredible design publishing house. And arguably the fastest growing design publishing house in the world, apparently, and over the last few years. And you reach a huge influence of, you know, architects and designers, et cetera, around the world. And you recently expanded into North America in 2023. What was life growing up in Sydney for you to begin with?
Yeah, life was good. I was incredibly lucky to grow up in the eastern suburbs of Sydney, go to a great school, and, you know, have a really great close group of mates that I grew up with. And, you know, life was good. It's, you know, can't complain here in Sydney, as you know. So, yeah. But for me, you know, growing up, sport was actually a major part of my life, which I think is where I got a lot of my competitive edge and drive from as well. But it was good growing up and again, a great school, great group of friends, and it's kind of shaped my life and who I am today.
Is that Waverley?
The College of Knowledge, that's right. The same as your boy, right?
Yeah, Luca went there for a little while. Not for the full time, but he definitely enjoyed that as well. And sport was mega.
Massive. Yeah, it's changed since then. I think it's more education focused now, which is good. But back in my day, yeah, it was heavy sport.
So you got a great eye for design and architecture. Certainly comes through in your brand, your publication and the videos. What got you into that? Have you always been interested in architecture?
It's an interesting way to fall into media and publishing, but I think the first place that I fell in love with design and architecture is during my, I guess, early teens and mid-teens. I was working on a building site every summer and, you know, getting a bit of pocket money. I would head on site doing, you know, the worst jobs imaginable, from lifting bricks and you know, digging up sand, but that was my first exposure to, I guess, construction, design, architecture. And I was lucky enough that these homes that I was working on and these kind of builders I was working with, they were some of the most beautiful homes in Sydney across the eastern suburbs. So growing up and doing that, it was kind of in my blood, the construction side of things and design and architecture. And it was really when I finished school, I actually studied architecture for a grand, I think, two and a half months, give or take. And I came to the realization that university and architecture isn't quite my cup of tea. I'm definitely incredibly impatient and, like I said, competitive and driven. So after dropping out of university, I actually decided to start making and designing furniture in a workshop in Botany where, I saved up every penny to hire this workshop in a shared industrial kind of community out in Botany and started making furniture and putting bits and pieces together, which was a bit of a leap of faith compared to obviously working on site and doing that. But it felt like a little bit of a natural progression for me. And I loved it. I loved using my hands, heading into work, doing fit outs, making furniture, which for the record, wasn't amazing. It was never great. But I think the thing that I loved the most, especially in this community workshop, was speaking to other makers and creatives and understanding who they are, what they do, how they make their pieces of furniture. And that was really the birth of the local project, where one day in this very dusty workshop, I was sitting down. I remember I decided to create an Instagram page, of all things, where I would put up my work, the fit outs and pieces of furniture I was doing. And I would also kind of take photos of these other makers in the workshop and put up their work in a small little caption about who they are, what they do, a little bit about the piece that they've made and where it's going. And my mates used to always give me a bit of stick where my furniture would get 2 or 3 likes, but the interviews and I guess other people's work would get 10 likes or 20 likes. So there was this sudden realization that I appreciated I enjoyed appreciating other people's work more than I guess my own. And I kind of went down this path of, celebrating makers, creatives, architects and designers, and, you know, 5 followers, and me and a bunch of other people in this workshop turned into 10. Turned into 20, and 8 years later, and obviously a few gaps in between, it's, you know, nearly 4 million audience members. But it really started in that workshop and just celebrating makers and creatives and the stories that they had.
And was there nothing else in the market doing anything similar?
I think in the digital space back then, like, Instagram was incredibly new. This was 8 years ago, and social and digital media, certainly isn't to where it is now, where it's almost the modern day portfolio. But it was relatively niche, and especially in the design world and circles. So it was interesting to see how rapidly we could grow because of this, how niche it was, and how few pages there were out there dedicated to celebrating Australian design or local design.
Yeah, that's actually true. The there's always been design books and design magazines around the world, and I know, working with a lot of these publications and publishers, that they were struggling with that transition into digital.
Definitely.
And yeah, I guess you just naturally kind of fell into that gap that was sitting there wide open.
That's right. Yeah, it was a bit of luck in between and everything, but you know, that's the interesting thing I find about the publishing world, is that there is a lot of innovation, but I think, you know, taking big pivots into new things like digital and social and the use of video, it can be a bit of a slow-moving beast, which is why I think an opportunity for me arose where I was this 21-year-old furniture maker who just started an Instagram account. I was doing what I felt was right and what I felt I wanted to see in this new space of digital, and I persisted and stuck at it, and here we are.
Yeah. And was it easy from the beginning? I mean, how long did it take before you got some kind of made it a commercial enterprise?
I think it was a slog, to put it perfectly. I think, and that's the beauty of starting a business, right? It's not meant to be easy, and there is the challenge there. But even though we rapidly grew, you know, right from day dot, where, you know, within the first year we might have had 30,000 followers, and by the second maybe 150,000 followers on Instagram. But
yeah, that's a lot.
It is a lot, yeah.
Well, but back then too.
Back then, but the commercialization of it was incredibly tricky, where, and I tell this story often, but I remember walking into potential partners and clients' office and saying, hey guys, there's, you know, this thing called Instagram and digital media, and, you know, I'd love to pitch you this idea of covering your brand and your products on our Instagram. And there was multiple occasions where, you know, I got laughed out of the meeting room and said, you know, Instagram and digital is a waste of time. And I think, you know, it's interesting that some of those brands are now some of our biggest clients as well. So it has come around full circle. But back then it was a slog. But I think that's what motivated me even more. You know, I have a weird relationship with rejection now, where, you know, getting laughed out of so many meeting rooms and kind of always having that uphill battle, it's created a bit of a numbness where, you know, I don't mind being told no and just figuring out another way around as well. So it's a bit of a blessing in disguise.
Did it get to a point where, like, how did you make a living in the meantime? Like, is that would have, if you stopped, were you still doing your furniture?
Still doing that, yeah. So there was this, yeah, for the first couple of years, it was half my time on building sites in the workshop and the other half on my phone scrolling through content and reaching out to architects, designers, creatives. So there was definitely a few meetings where I rocked up in, you know, my my chippy outfit looking a bit odd. But yeah, it was a nice little balance. And, you know, it was nice to go from something using your hands to, you know, emailing for the second half of the day. It was a really fascinating kind of pivot.
It's really cool to have that vision. I guess a lot of uncertainty around it, but there was enough behind it that drove you, that passion to make it happen.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
I think for me, like, momentum and creating something that is growing it's an incredibly addictive feeling. And I think a platform like Instagram or digital channels and social channels, there is a number that represents your growth, whether it's the amount of followers or the engagement and likes that you get. And
The data.
Yeah. Everything is data. And it was just, again, incredibly addictive watching this number grow and grow, and watching the number of messages come in from people within the community saying, love what you're doing, would love to meet you, would love you guys to feature us. And again, I'm incredibly competitive and driven as well. And I think the mix of that and just being pushed by these numbers and feeling the growth in this new space and being driven by rejection and eventually getting our first clients and partners, it's always been a wild ride. I think it probably still will be for the next 10 years. But I just love getting swept up in it and throwing my full self into it and just seeing where we land.
How did you shift from taking pictures in a workshop of other people's work and stuff to actually getting to video and video production? Because I think that's something that kind of really stood out for me, was seeing the early posts on Instagram that were the wrong way around.
Yeah.
They were landscape vertical.
Yeah.
That you turn the phone around, and that was kind of like, I didn't see anybody else doing that.
Mm.
I was like, I thought it was a mistake at first, but then what I realized is that she saw it in, you know, panorama, or what do you call it, the landscape, which, as you meant to, which is super cool, but also just how polished it was.
Yep.
Like all the homes that you were shooting, which I think predominantly was homes at the
That's
time,
right. Yeah,
were just beautiful kind of flow through a beautiful space.
Yeah.
And I guess at the time, less about the people behind it, but more about the beauty of the finished product.
That's right.
How did that shift happen?
I think, I mean, especially in the early years and even still to today, like, I spend a lot of my time consuming content, and especially from other industries and other brands, and understanding what does incredibly well in other sectors and trying to apply it to design and architecture. And one platform that I could see was on the rise quite a lot, you know, 7-8 years ago was YouTube, and obviously all the video content that was on there. And, you know, the type of content that I loved was just hearing professionals in their industry talking to camera, telling their story. And the thing that was most fascinating for me was actually putting a personality to that person and understanding how they speak, their accent, their little quirks, and understanding that person as well as you can through video. And it was definitely a goal and a vision from the get-go to eventually move into video, but the reality is it's incredibly expensive. It's incredibly time-consuming, you know, pre-prod and post-prod. There was all these things against me to actually do it immediately, but I'd saved up just enough money, and we were probably about 2 years into the business, and I'd saved every penny to work with this amazing production company down in Melbourne to shoot the Nightingale Housings, the first of its kind down in Melbourne with Jeremy from Breathe Architecture. And we filmed it, we shot it over 2 days, and we spent weeks and weeks editing it together. And I remember posting that first video on YouTube, and we had, you know, 3 subscribers. And, you know, we posted snippets of it on Instagram as well. The most impactful thing I felt off the back of that was the amount of messages and comments and engagement from people from this video, even though it didn't do the numbers of, say, a beautiful imagery, where Instagram back then was pushing still imagery more than ever. But the connection that had with our audience and hearing Jeremy, watching him speak and talk, it was like nothing I'd experienced before in those 2 years of rapid growth on the Instagram page. So that was just a massive tick for me, where I just said, you know what, the connection you can make with your audience through these people telling their stories it's measurable. Like, it's so incredibly powerful. So from that point, we just committed. We said, how do we make this work, and how do we produce as much video celebrating these people?
And it looked like that was the architects driving that? Were you inundated by architects going, hey, I want to, can you film my house?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, there is some nervous architects out there. So it wasn't all architects. There was a lot of developers and, okay. builders and a few creatives and makers as well. But yeah, I think the beautiful thing back then about the house tour content mixed in with the architects and occasionally the homeowner is everyone loves a beautiful home. We all live in a home and can relate to that. But then to add the different layers of personalities of the architect, the interior designer, and then the homeowner, hearing all of their different perspectives of how it come together was just, yeah, it was amazing. It was just great storytelling from them, and we just had to sit there and record it, really.
And so now you kind of, I guess at that time you're doing shooting over 2 days, one place, and editing for weeks and weeks.
Yeah.
Are you doing like dozens of them a day now?
It feels like it. Like it's, we had a week about a month ago where we shot 14 videos in a week, which, you know, across the globe now, you know, a couple in America, a couple in New Zealand, and then eight or so in Australia. So it's amazing to think of building up for 3-4 months to film that one video for, you know, that's probably the only video we did in 6 months. And now we're doing anywhere between, you know, 3 to 20 per week. It's, I think it, again, just talks to the power of video, and that's a massive driver for us as a business and connection with our audience, as well as a connection with our clients, because, you know, for these clients and partners who see this video content, and to have one of their collaborative architects or designers say, hey, this home is beautiful and it happens to feature an amazing product, ABC, that's authentic, it's genuine, it's genuinely spec'd in the home as well, and it's not, it doesn't feel like it's in your face, it's just part of the story. So it's a powerful way to advertise and again connect with an audience.
Does every video attract the same amount of attention, or does some like go through the roof?
It's interesting because I often look at our most viewed YouTube videos, and it isn't the biggest homes or the most expensive homes, it's actually the homes that have the most unique story behind it, or the most quirky interviews or architects or design details. And, you know, small apartments are a big one for us, where, you know, people have been incredibly intelligent about how they view space and design the space.
Yeah.
But interestingly, a lot of the homes where the homeowner has a lot to say and has talked about their experiences have done incredibly well. So it's not about the big, bold homes and spending squillions on the fit-out or spec or new build, but it's often, again, those characters behind it and I guess those interesting details that are relatable as well.
I know that it's like everybody seems to watch the local projects. You've done incredibly well. And my partner, Jess, she's constantly flicking me. I get it already, so I'm following you, but I keep getting sent that. Lucas sends me stuff. Friends in England send me stuff. The local project going, got to check out this house.
That's great. I hope you're watching it.
Yeah, no, I try to watch it all. It's like a full-time job watching all your content.
It is.
But it's always, I mean, of course, it's always professional. It's always slick. It's always like makes you feel something. Makes you feel good about design. It makes you feel you connect with it. Sometimes it's hugely aspirational, but as you say, sometimes you look at something that's much more of a smaller story and much more human, relatable in that regard. Mm-hmm. I think it was interesting that, because initially I thought maybe it's just all going to be about big, grand houses, which has a huge appeal to a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's interesting, even the name. It's interesting when someone starts a brand, and the brand at the first you go, huh, local project, or whatever the name might be, McDonald's, whatever it might be, that it takes a while for the brand to have meaning. And it's, you know, a brand isn't just a name, a brand isn't just a logo, et cetera. But it's that constant kind of 360 touch points and engagement with the whole brand that kind of makes the name kind of make sense and elevates that. How did that come about, the local project? Was it obvious for you? Was it instant? Was it just serendipity? Or did it work?
I don't think I've actually told this story ever before publicly, but
yes,
this
we've
is
got
the
a
debut.
First, folks.
Here we go. but the local project was actually the name of my furniture business before I started the business. So moving into this communal workshop and making furniture and doing fit outs, the name for me was the local project, because I was in with this great group of local creatives doing, you know, having a bit of fun knocking together some furniture. And yeah, weirdly, this kind of this pivot into design media and publishing, it's almost like it was meant to be in a weird way, because the name, and I get a lot of comments on the name, but it kind of perfectly sits, and it's celebrating how locality inspires design and influences design and designers. So yeah, probably a bit of luck in there as well, but it's actually my furniture business name that's carried on.
Yeah, that's super cool, and that's a lovely evolution from something that you did initially. Yeah. And I think that, I don't know, I just felt like when I very first saw it, and was it 8 years ago? Was it like
8 years? Yeah,
you were doing video 8 years ago.
Video probably about 6 years ago. Yeah,
oh, it seems like it doesn't seem that long.
Yeah, that's right. It's been a wild, a wild journey, and time flies, as you know. It goes real quick.
But it's just like I find it exciting when, because we're in the business of branding and design, of course, but to people to stumble across the local project for the first time today.
Yeah.
That's always cool. I love it when people come to Frost Collective and they go, or the podcast, you know, this podcast, and they have never heard of it before, even though we've been in business for 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, slightly longer than you were eight, but the time flies. But it's kind of, it's really cool when someone goes, wow, that's a really cool, the local project is super cool.
Yeah.
Have you seen it? So, yeah, it's been going for a while.
Mm. And to your point, like, I think there's been two pivotal moments in our business's lifetime over the 8 years that have really kind of shot us up and what people know us for best. And the first one is video and our YouTube channel. And again, talking to the connection that makes with an audience. Because if you think about video, and you know, our videos anywhere between 5 to 10 minutes, and they have a 50% completion rate. So that is, and you know, they average 500,000 to 1 million views per video. That is a lot of watch time per video and connection with an audience member, as opposed to Instagram, where it's, you know, you have a look at a photo, you like it, you flick on to the next one.
Yeah.
You know, even print, obviously it's a different type and you're sitting down and sourcing that, but video has been pivotal for our success. And when we meet a lot of people, or they come up to us and say we love the local project, I would say video and our YouTube channel is probably the first point of call. But the second most impactful, I guess, thing that we've done as a business and what we get a lot of reference for is that print side of things. And I think it also talks to, you know, the digital world that we now live in. And, you know, you've got TikTok, you've got Instagram, you've got EDMs coming through, you've got all these digital platforms that you get peppered every day with this content. I genuinely feel that print is making this amazing comeback, because it's a bit of an escapism from the digital world that we're plugged into so heavily.
Yep.
And there's nothing better than kind of detaching from that a little bit, sitting in a chair and flipping through a magazine. And I think the key thing for print these days, and it also talks to kind of longer form video, but is longevity, and actually creating something that isn't just a quick and easy, I'll flip through it and then chuck it in the bin, but something that will sit on a coffee table or in a bookshelf or wherever it might be for 2, 3, 4 years as well. And longevity is key in this game. And, you know, it's an object as much as it's a publication as well. And I think that's our success, because our magazine, if you can call it a magazine, is 400 pages. Our hardcover book that we release is, you know, close to 600 pages. Mm-hmm. These are all designed for 3, 4, 5 years in mind, rather than just a quick flip and then on your way.
That was my next question about the book.
Jump there.
No, it's good. It's good. Because just what you touched on, of course, is what I firmly believe in too. Which, I mean, it's a bit like the conversation around AI today. Like, is this the end of all our careers?
Yeah.
I remember when the computers came out that long ago, people going, oh, print is dead. Mm. I remember David Carson saying that print is dead. Way back, that was probably like 30 plus years ago. It clearly isn't. We're still, you know, doing a lot of digital work, but a lot of publications, magazines and books and stuff, you know, surrounded by them here, projects we're working on.
Yeah.
But it's interesting how you start off on digital, you see a gap in the market for doing Instagram, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
and video, but then you went into print.
That's right.
Whereas the print publications have kind of gone into the other way around, but they're still holding on to their publications, which are no doubt a hell of a lot less. Even the kind of the most famous interior design publications or architecture magazines are probably only selling a few thousand copies, whereas you're, again, you've hit that sweet spot, or you've got that following, that seems to be, or and also the fact that they're timeless. I don't think they have a date on them even, do they?
That's right, yeah.
So I get quite confused at which one's which, which is the latest. But there's a collectability around it. There's a almost like creating a bit of a legacy that you're collecting all these stories, an archive, the local project archive, which is super cool for anybody referencing any kind of design or architecture and stuff. There's something interesting too, is like not coming from a, you know, you're not coming from a kind of publication design or editorial background. How did you navigate that? How did you know what was right in terms for print to express the local project brand?
I think naivety has always been a blessing for me, in the sense that, like you said, I've got absolutely no background in publishing or editing, no background in digital or design, really, apart from that time I spent on a site. But I think naivety has been such a blessing for me, because I've come into this world and done just what I feel like I would want to read or see or watch if I was on the other end. And I think, you know, especially being, I guess, a younger businessman, where I'm happy to kind of pivot and we can be nimble as a business as well. It's been one of our biggest strengths, where, like you mentioned, starting off in digital for us has been so incredibly strong, because we built up that digital platform and social following from the get-go, and then have moved into print, where print has been so successful for us because we don't rely on stockists or airports or news agents to sell our magazine.
Yeah.
We rely on our 4 million audience members to head to our website and purchase the magazine or a subscription, rather than, like I said, going to an airport or news agent. Yeah. And that connects you directly with the audience member.
Yeah.
And it cuts out the middleman as well, and actually makes print profitable, which is quite nice as well. So, but yeah, I think for me, it's, and like I mentioned at the start of this conversation, it was interesting entering where what felt like quite a traditionalist industry, where there was a little bit of innovation, but there was also a lot of hesitancy around jumping into digital, jumping into video, and even still to this day, there's not a whole heap of video out there. But again, I did what I felt was right, and what I felt would help grow our audience and nurture our audience and what they wanted to see. And, you know, the numbers follow it, and the audience kept growing and growing. But I think what I realized pretty early on as well is that every unique medium has its own audience behind it as well. The people who read print is different to the people who watch TikTok, obviously, and watch video and, you know, spend time on Instagram, let alone the way that they interact with those platforms as well. So very early on, I adopted this, I guess, method of making sure we're creating content that isn't just a video, but let's also put that beautiful house in print, and let's also put it on our Instagram, so audiences can experience this storytelling through a variety of mediums as well. And it allows us to give a lot more love to the architects, to the designers, to the homeowners, as well as the clients and partners. And it's that multi-medium, I guess, approach to content, which I guess resonates with each way that person is consuming it as well.
It must be really interesting to see, kind of coming out of eastern suburbs of Sydney, based in Alexandria, putting this stuff out, and then to see how, or if, I guess at the beginning, if this connected with a global audience. And so how has that kind of, how has the ripple effect come about, or how has that been for you?
There's platforms like YouTube, which are very US dominated, Pinterest, which is very US dominated, even TikTok to an extent as well. And it's
been, although soon to be banned, isn't it?
Soon to be banned in the States. That'll be very interesting to watch that unfold. But it's interesting to watch these platforms be US or globally dominated. And I mean, I can't tell you, you know, we launched in the States early last year, but that was off the back of thousands and hundreds of messages from US firms and studios and audience members saying, you know, we love what you're doing in Australia. We watch all the content. We see it. We're watching from afar. When are you guys going to launch over here and start capturing content from North America and from Mexico and from even UK and Europe as well? And, you know, after, you know, plenty of knocks on the door and watching this data, because again, the beauty of digital is that everything is analytical in front of you, and watching our US audience and global audience grow and grow and grow, I thought I'd head over there and essentially just meet with some studios and firms and understand, I guess, what they wanted to see from the local project if we launched over there. And one of the very interesting things is, you know, I met with, on my first trip there, say 30 architects, and, you know, each of these meetings were an hour long. But I would genuinely say for the first 45 minutes of those meetings, these architects would just talk about their love for Australian and New Zealand design and their awe of what is coming out of this side of the world. Yep. So I think, yes, there is US-dominated or North American or globally dominated platforms, but it's not to take away from the work that's coming out of Australia and New Zealand is making a global impact, a huge global impact.
It's super interesting. I mean, and the market there is enormous. That's right. They've got hundreds of millions of people versus us, what, 26 million people.
That's right.
But it's interesting too, that shift. Now, we talk about a lot about that with architects who we work with. Domo Varro's on the next podcast as well. Nice. Good friend and amazing architect. About how Australian architects were often, for a long time, looking overseas for inspiration. Mm. And it's interesting, over time, the confidence and the diversity of architecture in Australia has been phenomenal. We work a lot in the place branding and environmental wayfinding on projects on large scale, small scale projects, public in the public realm, offices, residential, commercial, etc. And just see how that design is constantly changing for the better. It used to be so beige and kind of boxy and uninspirational. That confidence is, for me, I just see it as at an all-time high. What do you think has caused that? I mean, is it just time, or what is it? What's shifted? Because people used to always kind of bring in a star architect into Australia to do a project, and I mean, that still does happen, of course.
Yeah.
It seems to be like there's a confidence in design now that wasn't there before, even with people's homes. I know we have David Flack on before, and Yasmin. There's a confidence. They're not fearing the kind of to being creative or pushing boundaries and stuff like that. Whereas before, I felt it was far more careful.
My personal theory on it is that in the last 10 years, and with the rise of social and digital media, we're, as an industry, globally more connected than ever.
Yeah.
And I think that's given especially Australian architects and designers like Yaz and David more confidence than ever that, you know, the work that they are producing is at the highest of levels, and like the impact they have locally, which is huge and phenomenal, but on a global level as well. It's just, it creates this inbuilt confidence for the design industry here, and, you know, we can be appreciated. And, you know, I look at David's following and Yaz's following on social and digital media, let alone all the print coverage they get, and they've got more followers and a bigger audience than a lot of media publications these days. And
yeah, it's true.
I think, you know, it just again talks to that shift of appreciation and also normalizing of design. I think, you know, maybe 20, 30 plus years ago, design and architecture was considered a little bit elitist and only for the rich. But, you know, I meet young students and I meet, you know, people in their early 20s who have nothing to do with design or architecture, but they love watching house tours. They appreciate design on a whole nother level due to the connectivity that, you know, social digital media has created. So that's my personal theory, and which is great. I mean, that's what I see our responsibility as a media publisher is, to help normalize design as much as possible, and celebrating these, you know, amazing architects, designers, creatives is what we do. But I see a future of, you know, the David Flacks of the world and the Yazzes and all these amazing designers, and even the up and coming now, they will have more power than the media if they don't already, because they have created their own kind of publishing company in addition to the amazing work they do. And it's amazing to see the impact they have on a global and local level.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think the fact that we're even doing this podcast in the past was unusual, because it is publishing, it's content, you know, the magazine or the our books and things like that we do. Most of the time, creative organizations, whether interior designers, architects, are working for a client, but it's really cool, liberating around the fact that we can now create our own content and, I guess, direct the brands to the market that we intend it to be for.
Exactly.
Which is super cool. Let's talk about also more personal level. You have four pivotal anchors in your life. Talk to me a bit more about that.
Yeah, the four pivotal anchors in my life, I say, is my fiance, work.
She's first. Okay.
She's first, number one. Had to get that in, of course. Yeah. Work, which consumes me, obviously. Health and fitness is a big one for me, mental and physical, which admittedly goes in ebbs and flows, unfortunately, with work and being so consuming sometimes. And the fourth one being looking after my mum, who's been quite sick since I was 11, 12 years old, dealing with mental health issues, which has come with its challenges. But it's defined me as a person as well, in the sense that, you know, becoming the sole carer of her at 18 years old was never going to be easy. And unfortunately, I've had to deal with and see things that no teenager or, you know, early 20s or late 20s should have to deal with. But that's the hand I was dealt, and again, it's defined me as a person, and I've always taken it as it is. And I think probably, you know, one of the most pivotal points of my life was, you know, being 19, almost 20 years old, and, you know, sitting down with your mum and saying to you that, hey, I'm going to need $150,000 to help pay debts and mortgage. There is nothing that will drive you more as a person, as a son, as an individual, to succeed in life than having something like that said. And, you know, I can happily say, like, you know, at that point I was earning $500 a week. So it was a tricky moment then. But from that point, you know, I've been able to pay her mortgage and pay her debts and provide for her every day as well. So, but that is my life. It's you know, providing for people, looking for her, looking out for her, and it's something I deal with, and you know, it drives me.
I think that thanks for being very open about that too, because that's obviously an incredibly personal part of your life. But the fact is that, you know, we are human beings all trying to do our best, and in a way, design, I guess, has been a lot of the time in publications has been kind of positioned it like very elitist, very about perfection, about, you know, things being absolutely perfect, and I believe a perfect world is where we all look out for each other, our strengths and weaknesses, and we're all at different stages in our lives. We're all trying, you know, some of us are not as well as others, you know, and we should be, as you have been, helping each other to achieve the best life possible.
Definitely. I think it's
so well done.
Thank you
on that too.
Appreciate
and
that.
As you say, that kind of helps define you, makes you focus far more on not seeing it as a burden, but probably as an opportunity, and truly helping your mum, another person, you know, get on with their life and deal with their life and have the best life possible. So it just sounds like you've gone on overdrive with it, though.
That's right. There's no turning off now. But I mean, look at where I've landed. Like, my day today is celebrating, supporting architects and designers and people with the industry. So I think it's influenced me a lot from what I do on a day to day, let alone my personal life as well. But you're right, like the world spins through helping other people,
In the world of design and communication, it's harder and harder to be original. Like, there's so many times we do a project and we, you know, post it on Instagram, someone in Lithuania or somewhere says, hang on a minute, I did exactly that 6 years ago. And you go, yeah, well, can you show us? And it comes back, you go, holy crap, what a coincidence. But what do you feel about people intimidating your work?
You know, I used to get really salty about it, and I used to take it quite personally, but I think I then realised, like, hey, you're not the first person to create a video or the first business to celebrate an architect or whatever it might be. And I've since turned around and realised, to my point before, it's, you know, the more people and businesses and brands that normalise design, then that's great. So the more video content, the more print content, whatever it might be, the better. But I think there's also a fine line as well where, you know, we had a huge legal proceedings last year in the US where a company had started over there where they had copy-pasted our website, our logo, our T's and C's, like the full deal, and even started creating video content almost to a T.
I'm interviewing the wrong guy.
I know, that's it. I stitched you up there. Yeah, Daniel Hernandez over in the States is who you want to be chatting to. But it was bizarre. And it's like, it was honestly, it rocked me for six. I couldn't believe it was going on. But yeah, funnily enough, you know, we reached out to our lawyers who had their US attorney or their, you know, their collaborative lawyers over there. And it took a while to actually figure it out and get the business shut down. But it is the Wild West over there at the best of times.
Yeah.
But that was, yeah, a bit too close of a call for me.
That's kind of, we've had the over the years where, you know, it just knocks you, it just hits you in the head going, why would someone so blatantly copy? You know, we've had many times people formed Frost Design or something like that. Frost as a brand, which we've got copyrighted in Australia, but in the UK as well. But it's, I don't know if it's just naivety or imitation or, you know, I guess it's just like case
shortcuts,
by case.
Shortcuts, I think, is what it is.
But the issue is that you put so much time and energy into what you're doing, creating your brand, and then somebody comes along and tries to create something similar. And, you know, clients often sometimes can get confused with who's what, you know, and all the energy put out there by doing great things, you know, it comes back to you. It's kind of a circular economy in that regard. It kind of, what goes around comes around. And if someone kind of short circuits that by trying to get a bit of that themselves, it kind of, it affects the flow back to you.
Definitely.
And so also the quality, the representation of your brand as well is really important, because you obviously monitor and maintain that at a high standard.
That's right. Spent 30 years building it, right? It's a nice little slap in the face, but it happens a lot.
I'm not sure if you were spotty when you were at Waverley, but, you know, into sports, etc. But how did you shift from, you know, doing your own thing to being now managing a business of 60 people? What made you good at business?
A lot of learnings along the way, which I know is cliche, but, and so is this next statement, but, you know, I've made every mistake under the sun along the last 8 years in growing a business, managing a business. But, you know, it's been fun. Like, it's, again, like I'm addicted to that momentum and growth. And although I've never set out to have a business of 100 people or 300, that's not my goals and aspirations, but it's just the nature of growing so rapidly, especially in the last 3 years, where 3 years ago there was eight of us around a table in the office that you've been to in Alexandria. Yeah. And I'm thinking, how the bloody hell are we going to afford this rent and fit anyone else in this office? And now there's 63 of us and a couple of offices in the same complex. But yeah, I'm again incredibly competitive and driven. And I know this isn't the healthiest, but like, I try and think that no one will outwork me and no one will put in the hours I'm doing. So every time it gets harder, I enjoy that because I know no one else is going to try and follow that. So I just love the feeling of building something. And I'm not one to, if and when I make mistakes, which again happens all the time, I love learning from it.
Yeah.
Even if it goes disastrous, then so be it. But it is what it is. Let's move on and play on and keep building. So it's been, a journey and a lot of learnings. But the biggest learnings I've had in the last year and a half, 2 years, is that, you know, when there was 30 of us, a bunch of young creatives running around building this business, you know, a bunch of headless chooks doing incredibly well for who we were and what we were doing. But there is something so peaceful about bringing in amazing leaders into the business with a wealth of knowledge. And we have that with each department now, where we've got these amazing, strong, knowledgeable leaders. Mm-hmm. And there's this just sense of calmness in the business where I don't get 6 squillion questions every day.
Yeah.
There's this trust and autonomy with the business now where I can lead the strategic and creative plays. And I know these guys and girls are running their teams incredibly well and looking after their team. So it's a really great time for the business at the moment.
You've designed your business. Do you feel like you've designed your life?
I do, I think there's constant redesigns and constant upgradings and changes and shift, but it's always changing and going up and down as per work in those other three pillars as well, but I'm not afraid of change.
That's cool. Aidan, it's been so cool to have you on the podcast today. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Vince. Appreciate you a lot.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Design Your Life with the local project founder,
Aidan Anderson. Tune into next episode where I catch up with the phenomenally creative powerhouses Louise Olson and Stephen Ormandy, founders of Dinosaur Designs. Thanks for listening to this episode of Design Your Life. If you'd like to find out more about how you can design your life, head to the website at designyourlife.com.au. If you found this episode inspiring, please don't forget to review and subscribe. If you have any ideas or like to get in touch, we would love to hear from you. Send us an email at hello@frostcollective.com.au.